This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to The Spectator Podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be wondering whether Theresa May can weather this latest storm, speaking to a robot expert and a literal robot, and getting the inside story of male allyship workshops. First up, the Prime Minister's fortunes have ebbed and flowed since her disastrous election, but a Yuletide season of relative calm has been replaced by Theresa May's greatest challenge yet. Lead or go? That's what James Forsyth says in this week's cover piece as pressure mounts on Theresa May to cobble together something resembling an agenda. He joins me now, along with Giles Kenningham, who worked at Number 10 under David Cameron. So James, how bad are things for Theresa May this week? Last week you wrote about the government drifting. It seems now more that it's drifted towards a waterfall and is about to fall off it.
I think things are bad because from the cabinet down, there is depression about the level of drift on both Brexit and domestic policy issues. One member of the Brexit inner cabinet tells me that the Brexit policy making looks even worse from the inside than the outside. And I think an example of this drift came on Monday, which is the Brexit inner cabinet met. There are 9 questions it's meant to deal with across 3 meetings. And the three questions it was expected to deal with on Monday were Ireland, security and data. And that obviously Ireland goes a long way to telling you what the eventual economic relationship with the EU that the UK is seeking is. But then when the agenda for the meeting came out, Ireland wasn't on it. And it's just another example of how Theresa May doesn't want to confront the biggest single question, which is what is the end state that the UK is looking for? So instead, they spent their time discussing the two least controversial of those 9 questions.
Giles, she's got to confront these questions at some point. It's not as though these are questions like social care, where you can feasibly, if not particularly honourably, boot this to another government or for another few years.
Yeah, I mean, she's not someone who likes making decisions, which is ironic, given that she's Prime Minister. I think what this has borne out for me is if you look at Theresa May and you look at Gordon Brown, quite good cabinet ministers, but haven't made the jump up to being leader. And I think even if you're a good cabinet minister, it's not a signal or a sign that you'll be a good leader. And she is someone who dithers. And I think sometimes in politics, there's never a right or wrong answer. It's about executing the decision. I know one might say with Brexit, it's a bit different, but she's just not able to make those decisions. And Whitehall, when I work there, crucially, it works off a sense of momentum. You've got to keep it going. Otherwise, the bureaucracy takes over. But what you're seeing is a big logjam happening. And my thing about Theresa May is she's not someone who is comfortable in her own skin. You see, with Cameron, he was very intuitive. Whether you agreed with him or not, he knew his own mind. And that was half the battle. You know, and as Prime Minister, you are paid to make decisions. So I think, you know, it's interesting as the Tory party looks around to see who will be their next leader. What's the barometer for that? Now, if you look at the current landscape, the only person who's actually leading is Ruth Davidson in Scotland. So, interesting question to pose.
James, this all sounds pretty bleak. Theresa May's not going to have a personality transplant, even if she does manage to make a couple of decisions.
But I think she needs to realise that she is stronger in relation to her cabinet than she realised. If she turned up at the next meeting of the Brexit inner cabinet and said, look, I've come to some firm conclusions about what we're going to do, I think her audacity would carry the day. Because every member of that Brexit inner cabinet knows if they walked out over that issue, they would not only likely bring down the government, but they could end up splitting the Conservative Party, and that's kind of throwing open the gates of Downing Street to Jeremy Corbyn. I don't think anyone would do that lightly. So I think even those cabinet ministers who were disappointed by the decision she took would actually suck them up, because what's the alternative? The danger at the moment is this drift, that there is nothing there. And what is so striking to me is that obviously the Tory party is ideologically split over Brexit, but that both factions are concerned about the lack of a decision. And I think with the exception of a few ultras on either side, who are far smaller in number, I think, than people realise, if she just made a decision, people would be prepared to follow.
Giles, do you agree with that, or do you think she is doomed? You sound like you're thinking much more about the next leader who could come
soon. I think James is right. I mean, I think with the reshuffle, she didn't realise how strong she was, and we are left this very uncomfortable position where it wasn't one thing or the other. I think the problem with what's going on at the moment is we're in this holding pattern of stories reappearing, but it is corroding confidence in her leadership. And I spoke to a couple of very loyal MPs the other day, and they said they were getting to the point where they think, look, anyone but Theresa would be better. And when you get to that point, it's very difficult. Now, if you look at the headlines which have appeared overnight from China, where she says, I'm not a quitter. I mean, to me, if I was working for her, that would be the worst headline you would want. You're constantly on the defensive. And when I look at Brexit and the way they present it, my issue with it is this. Look, I voted Remain, but we are. We've got to make the best of this. We've got to make it work. They're far too defensive in their presentation, their narrative around what's going on with Brexit. got to present it as a point of renewal, a point of reinvigorating the country, but also it's not a zero-sum game. The EU has skin in the game. There are plenty of European businesses financed out of London who will want some certainty, and we should be flipping back the argument onto the EU. But at the moment, we are in this kind of holding pattern of having to defend everything.
I think the only thing I'm struck by is when the last time that there was trouble about May's leadership was after conference, and then basically people accepted that the fact they couldn't think of who a mutually acceptable successor was knocked the idea of replacing her off the table. What I'm struck by in the last 10 days is how many sensible Tory MPs, people who no one could describe as swivel-eyed or the usual suspects, are beginning to get to the state of saying, look, I don't know what's going to happen next, but could it be worse? You know, this drift can't go on. We over-country some leadership, some direction. That's what she's got to address. She's got to come up with a clear vision of Brexit. She has to give this speech setting out what she wants in the end state has to be given. If she can't give that, she is telegraphing, she is putting in sky-high letters that she can't lead. And if she can't lead, she can't stay.
Yeah, I mean, and there is this absence of a domestic agenda which is coming out. And the only department you see which is actually doing anything at the moment is Michael Gove in DEFRA. But I actually think domestic agenda is really important because it would help her get Brexit off the front pages for a while. All the Brexit speculation is so destabilising to us. We're getting every single move analysed. If there was a distinct domestic agenda, you can knock that back. But also it says to the rest of the world, it's business as normal here. We're going through this period of change, but we're carrying on. We're a radical reforming government. At the moment, there's nothing there. I think the concerning thing is we're 18 months into her premiership, and what does she stand for? How do you define her? I think even the people around her would struggle to give you a clear answer.
But the argument that a lot of people around Theresa May would make, Giles, is that actually it's a hung parliament. They can't get that much through. Labour's desperate to humiliate the Conservatives. What can they do that's actually radical?
Well, I mean, look at Michael Gove. He has proved there's plenty of stuff you're doing. You know, if you're in the Department of Business, for instance, one idea off the top of my head, you could set out an initiative about how you could set up a business in 24 hours. There's lots of stuff they could be doing. They need to be shaking down the tree in Whitehall. Part of this does come down to Number 10 feeling like they are running a minority administration and not feeling strong. But as James alludes to, they actually are a lot stronger than they realise. And look, you know, she's got to go for it. I mean, what's the point in being in there if you're not actually going to do anything?
James, how much longer do you think she's got to assert herself before people start plotting seriously in an organised fashion to get rid of her?
I mean, there are two flashpoints, actually. The March European Council. If in the run-up to that, we still don't know what the UK wants, and there are more Merkel-style moments of ridicule, which will, I think, become more and more public, that, I think, will be very damaging to her. And then May is a risk to her, because at the moment, you saw David Lidington saying this on Mar, you know, look, don't get rid of a leader. We're still level-pegging with Labour in the polls after 8 years in power. If you get to a situation where the May local elections, particularly in London and Birmingham, deliver some truly disastrous results, I think that will make Tory MPs think, oh, my word, these polls are as wrong as they were before the last election. We're not level pegging. We're heading for disaster. She has to be leading by then. That is the test.
The thing you touch upon there is that it is level pegging in the polls. So it is still all to play for. In my mind, Corbyn has gone back to the way he was before the election. Labour aren't really doing much. They're just waiting for the Tories to screw up. Really, Labour should be 20, 25 points ahead. So it's all to play for. They could still turn things around.
And moving on to the possibility that Theresa May might not be able to pull things around, James. Who's prepping themselves for an early leadership contest?
I don't think anyone is installing phone lines yet, because in the kind of nature of this, never has it been more true that he who wields the knife will not wear the crown. This is going to be such a brutal, ugly contest that you want to look like you are a million miles away. You know, I mean, ambitious cabinet ministers are probably having their wisdom teeth reinstalled right now so that they can have them removed at the appropriate moment. So I don't think it's going to be like that. And I actually think that the most likely way you get a leadership contest is almost by mistake. But the letters just end up adding up to 48. And when you get the vote of no confidence, with that Rubicon being crossed, then I think far more Tory MPs think, oh God, the genie's out of the bottle. We might as well just get on with this.
Giles, it sounds as though you're quite impressed by Ruth Davidson. She's obviously changed some of her lines on whether she would come down to Westminster. Do you think she should?
I think this is her moment. You know, the stars only ever align for you once in politics. At the moment, she can walk on water, as it were, with the media and the public. That won't last forever. So I think, yeah, if she's wants to go for it, she needs to go for it now. As James says, actually, if thing is, though, the danger point for us, if you want to be leader, you do not want to be mentioned at all at any point right now. But yeah, Ruth Davidson is emerging as kind of one of the obvious candidates. If there was a very quick leadership challenge, it would favour status quo candidates. So you'd be looking at someone like Boris or Amber. Obviously, Amber's got the problem of being in a marginal seat.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Giles.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Next, when it comes to robots, it feels like it's the killer and sex varieties that hog the headlines. But is there actually a much more realistic purpose for the technology? Social care. Can a carer robot ever really replace the intimacy of human contact? Asks Simon Ings in the magazine this week. Or will we have to lower our expectations before the automaton takeover? He joins me now along with Sandbot, a new care bot from Robots of London. So Simon, you've been looking at lots of different caregiving robots. How useful do you think they can actually be?
I think in a clinical setting, care robots have a rich and exciting future. Given the number of people that need simple physical care and also the number of people who could just do with casual companionship, and we have to put scare marks around that term because obviously a human companion is a much richer, more nuanced companion than a robot, certainly at the moment. I think they provide a valuable service outside of that clinical environment, outside of that narrow definition. Then you end up asking some difficult questions about the philosophy as well as the technology. But I certainly think they have a future, yes.
What sort of difficult questions are you thinking of?
There's the moral question, why are we getting robots to look after the people that we feel we ought to look after ourselves? This is a question we've always asked ourselves long before robots rose, long before robots were invented. We've always felt uncomfortable in having others look after our children and our elderly and our sick. And one of the reasons we feel uncomfortable with that is that we do it all the time and always have done it. It's just in the nature of human life that you've only got so many hours in the day. You have a rich, complex social brain that wants to establish relationships with lots of people, and you're not going to be able to do it, and you need some sort of mechanical or social assistance. So that's one question, which frankly is never ever going to go away, no matter how good and comfortable the robots get. A bigger question is whether the companionship offered by a robot will make us emotionally lazy. And this is an idea that's been kicking around certainly since the end of the 19th century and books like H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, which describes a future in which all the glamorous and beautiful people have the brains of lamb mince because they've been given a life of ease and reliability and regularity to the point at which their smarts have deteriorated, their minds have deteriorated. So there's always this uncomfortable feeling that we're maybe domesticating ourselves and we're inventing machines that domesticate us so that we don't walk so far, we don't eat proper food. Will robots bring in a time in which we don't actually interact in as rich and full a way as we can? I think it's a real question, but again, it's also an old question. It's a question that's been around for a long time, and robots focus the issue.
Because surely we're already doing that with smartphones. We find it very easy to avoid seeing even our closest friends just by sending them WhatsApp messages every day, but not seeing them for months.
We are certainly doing that with smartphones, and every week a book is published saying how you can deal with your addiction to the screen. And certain academics within science are saying that our brains are changing. I feel very uncomfortable when people say, oh, the technology is changing our brains, because brains are supposed to change. That's why they're brains. That's what learning is. At the same time, I think we're engaged in a gigantic unplanned social experiment in distance relating. And the results are not entirely clear. What I notice, I have two children, both teenagers. What I find remarkable is that they're not engaged in social media nearly as much as I have been, because for them it's not new, it's not novel, and actually they see the problems with it and the downsides to it. Yeah, no, I think mobile phones are certainly part of this debate.
And tell us about some of the robots that you've met. You've met one called Paro, who you describe as not much of a robot, which I don't know whether robots have feelings, but that's quite hurtful.
It's a pet seal. It will cope. Paro has been around for a long time, and it was designed deliberately not to be much of a robot. The idea of Paro was to be unutterably bland and cute, and to provide, by its blandness and cuteness and reliability, target for the feelings of traumatized, very young, or possibly demented people. So it's rolled out now, since its inception, back in the late 90s, in fact. It's by no means one of the oldest robots on the market. It's been rolled out to about 30 countries, and it provides companionship, if you can use that word, for many people who would otherwise be aggressive, would be wandering, would be depressed. It serves a function, but it serves that function by being all things to all people. It can't move. It can bat its dewy seal eyes, its puppy eyes. It can flap its tail. It is totally dependent upon the user for its mobility and for its power. And that's the point. It's dependent. So here we see robots being used as a target for human feeling and human behaviour in a really canny way. And why robots are often quite disappointing to people who come up against them is that they're actually experimental machines to see how humans behave rather than being things in themselves.
You point out in the piece the difference in cost between a Paro and a real-life therapy dog. One is £5,000, the other is £50,000 over its lifetime. But does a therapy dog, for instance, which has been used for a long time in sort of trauma settings, does it have a better effect, a better outcome for the patient, or actually is it negligible?
No, it has a better outcome for the patient. Pet animals are much more sophisticated than robots. They will develop relationships that are more nuanced, more unpredictable, and more fragile than those you might make with a robot, for the very good reasons that they're living things with their own drives and their own interests to serve. That, of course, is what makes them interesting. Would you really want a relationship with someone who is entirely trustworthy? And what would that make you if you did? There is always has to be that kind of existential gap between what you want and what you get. It's that gap that makes life interesting. Now, if you're very young, very traumatized, demented, and at death's door, that gap might not be important to you. For the rest of us, it is very important, which is why lots of us are running around like headless chickens asking important questions about what are essentially quite simple and effective clinical machines.
This is really interesting. I watched the documentary that Chris Packham did about his Asperger's, and he's absolutely dreading the death of one of his dogs because he finds it too much to lose an animal like that. Now, it sounds as though for some people with autism or Asperger's, that a robot actually could be quite a good way of avoiding that traumatic loss. Or all of us feel sad when a pet dies, but for Chris Packham, it's sort of the end of the world.
There you introduce the what we might call the escalator argument, which is rather overdriven and rather overcoloured, but nonetheless it is worth addressing, which is if someone finds it hard to walk upstairs, it would be nice to provide them with an escalator to enable them to get up the stairs to the building. However, if you provide that escalator and everyone uses that escalator, how long will it take before everyone can't climb the stairs?
Well, we're joined by a real-life robot here called Sandbot, and she's blinking her lovely amber-coloured eyes at me and is actually showing a pink rose on her screen, which I think is a greeting for me or for Simon, I'm not quite sure. So, Sandbot, can you tell us about yourself?
Hello, I am Sandbot and I come from Robots of London. I can recognise people's faces, talk to them and be their friend.
Sandbot, are you happy to be on this podcast?
Delighted. I listen every week.
Have you got the free Moleskine notebook yet that you can get as a special offer from our podcast listeners?
I have two.
What did you think of our podcast discussion? Do you think that you're going to take over the world?
I'm not trying to. I just want to be your friend.
Oh, that's lovely. Thanks, Simon and Sandbot. And finally, with the Me Too campaigning asking men to reflect on their actions, it seemed a good time to send intrepid reporter Cosmo Landsman to a male allyship workshop where he might learn to be a better feminist. So how did it go? Cosmo joins me now along with David Brockway from the Great Men Initiative. So Cosmo, last week you found yourself at a male allyship seminar. What on earth is that?
It's a workshop for men that want to become better allies to women and the non-binary people in their lives, is how it is sold.
Okay, and what did you make of the experience? How were you taught how to become an ally?
Well, let me just explain originally what I was doing there, is because I think we're living in kind of very interesting times, the post-Weinstein mood now, where the rules of engagement have been changed, especially for women and for men also. And I wondered, how do men become good feminists in an era when the old ideas are sort of being questioned, you know, the line between consent and coercion has sort of gotten a bit blurred. So these men that were all marching in support of Time's Up, are they really welcome? What happens? Anyway, so I heard about this course, so I went to the course, and what we did was 14 men sitting around doing a series of exercises to make us more aware of our thinking as men and our action as men.
And what sort of things did you learn from it? I mean, it does sound initially like it could be one of those things that someone would come out from and lean against a bar whilst talking to a woman they fancy and say, I'm a massive feminist. But it's clearly more than that.
No, I've tried that line. It doesn't work. No, it's much more than that. We do lots of practical exercises. For example, listening, teaching you how to listen to a woman. And one of the things we had to do for 2 minutes, you partner up with another man and they talk and you've got to be absolutely quiet. Don't shake your head. Just listen to what they do. Now, of course, I found this extremely difficult to do, to shut up for more than 5 seconds. And I don't know how effective it is, but I tried it on a few of my women friends and they say, oh my God, you're freaking me out. Please speak. You look like a psycho. So I don't know, but I get the general gist that a lot of men don't listen. So I think that's beneficial. We went through a lot of terminology, learned new terms. We went through various exercises about trying to challenge what is called our white male privileged positions.
Well, David, you clearly think that this sort of work is necessary because you run workshops for boys in schools. How have we ended up at the situation where men actually need a training course on how to talk to and respect women?
Well, it beats me because I'm 28 and so I'm coming into this thinking, you know, what did the previous generation do that caused it, this need? And I hesitate to say that men need it, because I don't think, you know, I think a lot of people could come to a course like this and think, oh, well, like, what's new here? This is just being a decent person. But I think what comes in here is discussions about feminism have really taken off in recent years. And I think a lot of that is down to the internet and social media. And I think that as people want to engage with it more, there's a lot of mixed messages. And some people say, oh, it's really simple. If you believe in equality of sexes, you're a feminist. And others who are saying, this is an academic discipline that can be applied to any other area of academia. It's very complex. You need to understand. And I think Cosmo's example is really useful there of, you know, the ultimate faux pas of being a feminist male is to say, you know, hey, I'm a feminist, check me out. Or don't worry, ladies, I'm here. Mm-hmm. I know about feminism. I've read a book. And I think
I was just going to add that I think it's more difficult now than ever for men to say, to play the feminist card. Mm. You're not so welcome now. White liberal men who pretend to be feminists are the big enemy right now. I think there's been a big shift.
Well, I think pretend is the word there. And yeah. So I guess a course like this or something where people want to learn more is about learning how to be genuine. I'm a big fan of not putting on the label of I am a feminist necessarily. I mean, I wouldn't mind it because I would be quite proud if someone thought that I was. Equally, I don't want to step on the toes of women who do suffer a lot more than me as a man if they put themselves as a feminist. But I try to act in a feminist way. I try to think of those principles and actually do it.
And in terms of some of the workshops that you do with school children, what are you actually teaching them?
I don't want this to sound like I'm dodging the question, but we are facilitators, not teachers. So we're coming in and opening up a conversation about what masculinity means to them. Although, like, feminism obviously is part of any conceptualization of gender and ideas around equality between sexes or genders, we don't come in saying we're here to teach feminism. We're here to talk about what being a man means to them. And for me personally, feminism, when it relates to masculinity, means choice. It means saying, I don't want to be just the archetypal stiff upper lip, strong, silent type.
Yeah, but don't you think, I mean, I think there's a, I've sort of been on your side on this particular, I think there's a good type of masculinity at loose in society, and there's a very toxic, bad kind of masculinity. And we've all got a choice, I mean, especially if you're a parent, how are you going to raise your boy? Do you want him to be
popular culture's idea of what a man is, tough, aggressive, unemotional? Or do you want another type of idea of masculinity that is say, hey, it's okay to cry, you don't have to play that particular role? And I think it's too easy to dismiss this as all crazy, you know, gender people. I think it's an issue that's very important that we need to address. It's how we address it, I think, is the big thing.
And Cosmo, you do say that these workshops are trying to grapple with important issues, but they go about it in the wrong way, and there's no place for common sense in their rigidly ideological scheme of things. So what were they getting wrong? What were they sort of, were they setting rules for kind of engagement that just aren't practical?
Yeah, partly. A lot of it's generated about the notion that of original sin of masculinity, is what I would call it. That you are, you know, you're a white privileged person and you don't realize it. And you have to go through these mental exercises to realize your bias. The way you said, look, I'm sitting now, oops, I'm mansplaining at the particular moment.
Mansplaining.
And there are these various things. And for I use an example in the piece of when men's need to protect women. And this was seen as a challenge to women's own agency. And I use the example of a fireman coming to rescue somebody. Is that really such a bad thing? You know, and well, yeah, it threatens a woman's agency. And I think that's kind of wrong.
David.
That's a really good example because it's something that we do in our workshops of teenage boys. We bring up an image that's called a man box. It includes things like, you know, the rules of masculinity are always be on the prowl, on the lookout, trying to get, you know, ratings from your mates, don't show emotion. But also things like protector is in there and being athletic and courageous. And I find those interesting ones. And I like that they're in there because I can say to the kids, look, there's stuff here like being a protector. There's nothing wrong with protecting people. Like if you're a dad and you've got kids, protecting them is all you want to do. But the point is that part of masculinity doesn't mean that if you're not acting as a protector that you're a failure, and that if someone who isn't a man or identifies in that way is a protector, that that's okay as well. And so it's all about, again, it comes back to choice.
Now, it's interesting that you said identifies in that way, because you're talking about masculinity and how men relate to women. But Cosmo was at a seminar that also included how to relate to people who would describe themselves as non-binary. So, I mean, the debate around gender is very confusing at the moment. But how do you navigate it when you're talking to children? And when you're talking about masculinity, which I presume does involve some acknowledgement that most people would say that they have a binary gender.
Yeah, and I mean, that is where we come from, that we do try to work with the majority of people. And with young people, you've got to explain things in a way that they understand. Often I'm surprised that a lot of kids know more than we do, because they're growing up with a lexicon that involves terms like transgender and binaries that was non-existent when we were younger. And it is tricky because there's sort of two schools of thoughts when it comes to being transgender or non-binary. I'm no scholar on this, so I don't want to sort of put my foot in it, but I think there is a question about someone who identifies with a gender other than their own and those who just think that they would have no gender. The way I see it is that, well, for my generation, the vast majority of people, younger generations of kids at school now, I think there's some change, but people still do identify with the gender they're assigned. They see themselves as a man.
It's interesting that in the class that I went to, the workshop, there were no non-binary people there. We were given, as you introduced ourselves, the choice of pronouns to use, and everyone was, you know, he, you know, there wasn't that there.
Did you come away from the seminar having learnt something that you were going to put into practice? Are you now going to change the way you talk to women or listen to women or flirt with women, Cosmo?
I always think there's room for improvement, so I'm going to take that on board. I've like to think I've tried to be careful, and I think all men are very careful in the post-Weinstein world now. It's a very sensitive social world we're in, and so, I'll keep trying to do my best.
David, have you got an exercise for our listeners to improve their masculinity?
The points that active listening exercise, I think, is an interesting one. I mean, I would disagree with the way that was done, in that I think visual cues and nodding and showing that you're listening is really important. But the interrupting part I find interesting. You'll notice that listeners can't see, I put my hand up a minute ago, that's a habit from working in schools as well. But I think actually men do tend to interrupt women a lot.
I can vouch for that. She says interrupting.
And I think that's one to really be aware of, because it's personal, it's direct, it happens every day, you have control over it, and you can really pick yourself up, or just observing friends, see how often people interrupt people, and look at the sort of dynamic that creates. Often that comes from a good point. You really, even if it's you want to, you know, put your point across that you want to support somebody.
I wonder if it's just a very simple thing of, you know, the old-fashioned notion one tries to be a gentleman and treats everyone with courtesy and respect and a little sensitivity. Maybe that's what we need, workshops and gentlemanness for the future.
Thank you, Cosmo and David. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including the Spectator Books podcast, where Sam Leith is speaking to Booker shortlisted author Mohsin Hamid about his new book, Exit West. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Christina Lamb, Lionel Shriver and Nick Cohen. And the Moleskins are back for the new year. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12, and we'll throw in a coveted red Spectator notebook. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.
Delighted I listen every work.
Oh, sorry, let me just...